want to understand the world around you more intimately, not just how we humans tick, but all the other species that we share this patch of the universe with. It's never too late to put that curious mind to work, even if you've long left high school science behind you, because environmental scientists need lots of data. Collecting it on a large scale takes a whole lot of money and resources that are hard to get. So enter citizen science. And we've talked about this before on Life Matters, but here's a great story. And we're going to hear about an alliance between scientists and one large local community. I'm joined this morning by David Booth. He is Professor of Marine Biology at the University of Technology, Sydney. Welcome.
Good morning, Natasha.
A fish man.
And from indeed.
Indeed. We're going to hear how and why. And on the south coast of New South Wales, we have Libby Hepburn. She's chair of what's called, intriguingly, the Atlas of Life in the Coastal Wilderness. Hi, Libby.
Good morning, Natasha.
Hi, Libby.
Hi, Dave.
I want to start with those fish, because you do all sorts of things with fish. but one of your key interests is tracking the migration of tropical fish up that east coast of Australia. Why is that of such interest to you?
Well, we call it the NEMO Project, I suppose, because
Beautiful.
We're doing exactly that. For 14 years now, we've been surveying the arrival of these little tropical fishes over the summer months into places from Coffs Harbour down to where Libby's from, down at Maroomerilla and Eden, and getting really lovely fish information, but also information about the changing climate and the effect on the local fauna.
That's right. So what does that tell us about that relationship? Because that is a key interest, isn't it? You're part of a collaboration, a citizen science collaboration with Climate Watch around that.
That's right. I'm on the science committee for Earth Watch, which runs this Climate Watch program, which is a pretty unprecedented thing. It's mainly terrestrial, and it's now moving into the marine environment where citizens can log into an app on a phone, actually, and enter data they find and with the location. And over time, we gather enough information to tell us if things are changing.
Mm. So give us an example then of tropical fish that you're tracking and how their movements are telling you something about climate change.
Well, the East Australian Current that everyone pretty much knows about is strengthening, and it will strengthen in the next hundred years. And so the babies are coming down, but that's not the end of the story, because it's the survival over winter. As you can imagine, these guys aren't used to our cold temperatures, and in Sydney it drops to 15, mm. In Maroombilla it's a chilly 13 or 12, and they can't handle that. However, on the odd warm winter, when it gets to 17, only drops to 17, they survive. So we're right at the edge of things. And so as the temperature warms every year, we're seeing more and more of these overwintering baby butterfly fish, damselfish and things like that.
Yeah. So why did you turn to citizen science?
Well, I've always been interested, and I've worked with community programs for many, many years, for my whole career, actually. For the first thing, we just don't have the funding or the resources. This sort of work requires a lot of people out there looking. We don't have those facilities. We handle Sydney, but when we don't live down in Maroombilla, and that's a key spot. That's the last stopping off point for a lot of these tropicals before they drift out to the middle of nowhere and perish. So it's very sad. And so Libby and
that's their life cycle, drifting down from the warm waters of the north.
That's right. A lot stay up there, but a lot get pulled down with the East Australian Current, and they can crank for 1,500 kilometres. We know that they're coming from the reef, arrive on a nice place to live down in Maroombilla, do quite well until the temperature drops, and then most of them die.
But you need the eyes.
We need the eyes. We need the numbers. We need to know what happened last week and this week. And this week, for instance, we popped out, and luckily we went. There was a whole huge number of baby butterfly fish have arrived in Sydney. We're waiting for that same wave of arrivals to happen down in Maroombilla.
Isn't that lovely to have that vision of a whole stack of butterfly fish just arriving in a harbour somewhere?
They're absolutely gorgeous, but they tell us something.
Describe
about
them.
Well, the little ones we get are a golden colour with stripes and little eye spots and all sorts of things. The collectors love them, and they maybe eventually will build a home down here, but they're certainly a really attractive thing for people to see, and they're like little measurers of the effects of climate.
So what have you got people to do, the citizenry that are involved in these projects?
Well, some of the citizenry have helped us by snorkel. We do snorkel surveys, not diving so much, although some of the divers give us information as well. And the other interesting place to look is rock pools. And these little tropicals seem to prefer rock pools. And my ex-honours student, Patrick, works with Libby. You'll hear more about that in a minute, down helping the citizens sort of gather the data for us down there.
Okay, so they're combing rock pools and they're diving and snorkeling. Libby, let's head to your neck of the woods. It's a glorious part of the world. And this is an intriguing title that you're calling your project, network or group, the Atlas of Life in the Coastal Wilderness. What is it? It goes well beyond fish.
Oh, it does. The interest was largely coastal to begin with, but for about 6 years we were looking for a database to put our information about the things we find here. And then a few years ago, 3 years ago nearly, I think it was now, the Atlas of Living Australia, which is the national database, was just opening its doors to citizen science, to community projects. And it seemed to us that this was absolutely ideal, because what we were concerned about is that the things that we were recording were put somewhere where all scientists and all community members could get at them. So we're a link, our project is based on the Atlas of Living Australia database, and we're just a portal for that really. But what it allows us to do is to create our own surveys, to do all the kinds of things that we want. But as we do that, we can record all our images and our records in the national database.
Mm. So what sorts of stuff are you collecting? And we'll get to this BioBlitz that you're hosting this weekend, because that I looked at the range of surveys that you're going to get people to do, and it's just gorgeous.
Isn't it just? Yes. Yeah. It's the second one that we've done. But what we do here, individual people can make individual sightings and log those in. We've set it up now so that they can, we've got a project called My Place, where people can actually set it up so that they can create a database, a biodiversity list of things that around where they live or somewhere that they like to go to.
Yes, I saw a great posting of a swimming snake.
Yes.
So it comes down right to those individual encounters with the critters in your world.
That's right, but it also means that we can do things like setting up the long-term marine ecology project, which is to do with the Climate Watch beach surveys, but it's also we're setting up the rock pool surveys, and we're working with snorkelers and the scuba groups and also the local abalone divers to do some serious long-term underwater marine ecology research, and that can all go on there. So it can be basically any kind of survey which is based on the Darwin Core identification can go onto the website. So it can cover birds, it can cover flora, it can cover, as you see from the BioBlitz list, it can cover virtually every living thing.
Yeah, rabbits and bats and, not reptiles, beg your pardon, and birds and bats and terrestrial mammals and water bugs and
shell middens and canoe surveys, all sorts of things are going on, so it's great fun.
What's the motivation for the abalone fishers locally being involved?
Well, again, it's as David said, the resources for scientists have been much reduced, and gradually over the years the abalone divers have come to realise that they're the people who are best placed to manage their fishery. And one of they've been learning with the scientists about the life cycles of the abalone and the things that make the difference. And now what they're doing is they're using GoPro cameras to actually film their fishing grounds. They're collecting this data so they can use it to validate the sustainability of their fishery and to talk to the people who make the rules about the fisheries. But we can use it. What's wonderful about it is they go places that we'd never get to, us community members, and they're giving us their videos so that we get these videos of the underwater ecology. And our project was going to be based on marine macroalgae, because again, that is something which is in this particular area is changing very rapidly and moving southwards. And with the great marine seaweeds, if you lose those, you're losing all the ecosystems for all the other creatures here. So we're very concerned to develop a database of what's going on with that. And the abalone divers are giving us their resources to help. It's great.
Sounds fantastic. Professor David Booth from the University of Technology, Sydney. There's a question of the integrity of data collected. Now, I wonder how that all works, how you ensure that it's good quality data, that it's consistently collected, because this could draw some scepticism from your fellow scientists, this recruitment of locals to gather data for you.
Well, I think community gathered data has come of age, and you're absolutely right. There's been a massive debate in the scientific community over the years about the value of community data, and a lot of people have just written it off, or at least we're educating them. Now, we want a lot more than that. We want the people to get a satisfying situation, but we want the data. And so
we want the data.
It sounds a bit draconian, doesn't it? But and people want us to want the data because they don't want to be patronised, if you like. And some of these people, like those abalone divers, are incredibly knowledgeable on their species. They go there regularly. They take these amazing videos, and we can't get to these places. And so, but to talk about accuracy and that sort of thing, what we do is if we have an observer. I've had an observer down in Marimbula, Luke, for about 14 years now.
What's Luke been up to?
Luke has another life, but he certainly does some interesting things with national parks, etc. And was a scientist, a student up at Southern Cross University where I met him. Now he's been doing these surveys, but in the beginning we did parallel surveys, and we assured ourselves that we were the same. We counted the same things and we measured the same sizes and things. So there's often a period of comparability that we do. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a rigorous process these days, and papers have actually been published on this to show the accuracy of this sort of thing. But for sure, you need to make sure it's useful data.
How would you describe what that local knowledge brings you as a scientist living in Sydney?
Well, Marimbula is another classic case. There's someone on the spot. I mean, he will do weekly surveys for us, but he's out. He surfs. He looks at the ocean. He knows when a southerly wind's coming up that might blow some of these tropicals on shore. He works with the Marimbula Aquarium. There's just that local information. If something else happens, a turtle might wash up on the beach. Now, that's not a fish, obviously, but we're very interested in that. That's an indicator of apparently a climate event.
Mm. Well, Libby, just thinking about the people that you're corralling, bringing together to do this. Because we're running out of time, what about the BioBlitz? Tell us about that, because this is a great example of what's possible.
Well, this is something I saw first in the UK, and it was the Natural History Museum that had started this. And I was lucky enough to go to one there and thought it was a brilliant opportunity. People enjoyed themselves so much being with scientists and learning from them. And I really thought that this was something that we should look at here. So we did our first one 2 years ago at Bermagui, and we had nearly 300 people there, and we got 1,600 records and 855 species in 2 days. And everybody had a ball, and even I did, who was the one who was doing most of the organising. So it was, I just think they're wonderful events that bring everybody together. And community are so respectful of scientists and naturalists. They want to learn so much that it's a really good opportunity to do that. But Natasha, can I say that in terms of the validity of the data, we too were very concerned about the things that we send up to the national database being valid scientific records.
Yeah, you don't want to waste your time.
So we have now 24 moderators who help us with all of the sightings that are put in. We ask for photographs, and we ask these moderators right across the board to validate the records that are coming in. So nothing that we do get sent up to the national database until we've had two experts have a look at it. So that we are hoping here on this area over time to build a really important scientific record of what's here.
Very rigorous indeed. Have there been any surprises along the way in terms of what people have found or spotted?
Oh, yes. I mean, Dave was talking about the turtles, and it's something that we've noticed here over the last year or two is the number of very weakened turtles that are turning up. And if we can find them early enough, they can be looked after and rehabilitated because they come down here and they get cold and they don't feed properly. So that there are things like that. We've had tropical snakes found on the beaches here, marine snakes that have come down here, and we're finding a lot of different things are changing their ranges, and that's one of the things that we're really trying to do is to note things down which are interesting or unusual, because things are changing all over now.
Yeah, I can imagine it really changes people's sense of space and place and where they live. David Booth, Yeah, look, I'm just thinking about the news yesterday, for example, that the Australian Antarctic Division might lose some core funding, and indeed CSIRO is facing cuts too. I guess you don't want to send the message that your work can be done by citizens exclusively with a few supervising scientists.
Certainly not in Antarctica.
No, well, and that's right. Citizen science would be really hard to pull off there.
That would be very interesting, wouldn't
it? Yeah. But, just thinking about the climate in terms of science funding, you have to be careful, don't you?
Well, I suppose so, but I think funding people are very interested in the national benefit of what we do. One of the national benefits is actually linking with the community. And so it can actually assist in funding. It hasn't really worked for me so far, but I've heard that it can assist for funding when you incorporate the citizens. And certainly the New South Wales State Plan clearly links environmental research with social science and linking with people. So I think it's a thing that's come of age.
Well, good luck with the Bio Blitz.
Thank you very much. And we've also setting up a national association in Brisbane in May. So citizen science is definitely coming of age.
As it has in other parts of the world, there's a great open-air laboratories project in the UK. So just as I let you go, what is that national association going to be? Is it going to be focused on citizen science?
Yes, absolutely. That's what it's there for. There are enough people here now doing that, doing citizen science in all sorts of different ways, that we feel it's time that we got together and worked, networked across the country.
Ooh,
and
fabulous.
Networked across what we're doing.
So it'll have a website and a Facebook page?
It has got a website. It only started last week.
And what's it called?
It's called the Citizen Science Network.
Okay, we'll link to that on our page if we can find it, or the Facebook page.
Yes, and now BioBlitz is based on the OPAL model because we think that's such a wonderful project.
Fantastic. I might throw that link up on our Facebook page as well. Libby Hepburn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chair of the Atlas of Life in the Coastal Wilderness, based on the south coast of New South Wales, and Professor David Booth, a marine biologist at the University of Technology, Sydney. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Natasha, and thanks, Libby, and all the volunteers too.
Yay volunteers.
Yay volunteers.
And we'll put more detail on the Facebook page. I'll try and get that up before the end of the show. Let's see how we go there. Well, just enough time to squeeze in some of your calls in response to our story yesterday. You might recall that we were talking about the challenges for grandparents who become full-time carers of their grandchildren, particularly the financial challenges, and here are three of your calls.
Good morning. I'd just like to raise awareness that grandparents who have kinship care of their grandchildren do not have the same financial or legal parity as foster carers, and I think this is a great injustice because, if anything, we work harder, we're more invested, and we're older than foster carers. Thank you.
My name's Anne. I'm a worker who supports grandparents who raise grandchildren. One of my concerns in the clientele I work with is that the load for grandparents is doubly difficult because fairly frequently the grandchildren are negatively affected by their experiences, not only just with the parent who's got the mental illness substance addiction problem, but also sometimes the grandchild is affected even in the womb by the substances that have been used during gestation, pregnancy. And so I think the grandparents have got this huge load, their own difficulties, their own medical, their own frailty, their own tiredness, let alone the financial stuff. And also they're dealing with kids who've got sometimes extremely erratic, extremely challenging behaviours. And these grandparents, if they're not given enough support and training to deal with those kinds of behaviours, then I just almost think it's almost too hard. That's just a personal opinion. But that's my experience from working with this clientele. Thank you very much. Bye.
Good morning. I'm Glenda Stevens from Homelessness Australia. Unfortunately, this is an increasing number of grandparents are forced to bring their grandchildren into homelessness services, particularly in areas like Western Australia, where the cost of housing is astronomical. Housing insecurity is already a problem for many older people, particularly women. And as one of your callers remarked, it's a huge challenge for someone who's relying on government payments to maintain private rental housing. And then adding the responsibility of grandchildren to their financial burden can often tip older people into homelessness. And we just can't have older people sleeping in the streets or sleeping in the cars with their grandchildren, as so many other people are forced to do in areas where housing rent is so high. Boarding houses don't cater for them either. And we can't start rotating older people with grandchildren through motel homes like is done with many homeless families. So So we need as a community to start planning with homelessness services to deliver better to this wonderful group of older people who are raising a second family with their grandchildren. And governments also need to think about preventing them becoming homeless in the first place. And one of the ways they can do this is by increasing the supply of affordable housing and improving tenure security in the private rental market. We want grannies who are raising their families for the second time, being their grandchildren, to be secure and able to raise those children as best they can. Thank you for your time. Bye.
And thank you for lending your expertise to that conversation yesterday. 0283 1430 is our listener feedback line. We love hearing from you anytime. And you can also email us as well. Our website, abc.net.au/rn. Look for Life Matters. It's all there, including a full archive of audio.